Well, I'm the last speaker. It's my job to try to sort of wrap up, and I think you'll understand why I'm really not going to try to summarize any of the amazing amount of wisdom and experience and intelligence that we've just heard. Actually, it's kind of humbling, I think. Let me say this. I'm here tonight to speak on behalf of Chicago Labor Against the War. But I need to say something on a personal note in terms of what I've heard tonight, in terms of the changes that I think this has made in our society. As Carol said, I'm not from here, wasn't born here. Where I come from, it's no big deal to say you're a socialist. At least it wasn't back then. I'm not quite sure because I was absent during the whole of the Thatcher era, for which my father held me personally responsible. But so when I was first living in the States, I lived in Miami where I met my wife, who is here tonight. And there was a day when I was taking a book to read at the beach. And, you know, it was Miami in 1980. And the Cuban population was somewhat dominated by the right wing. And I'd had a few kind of ugly arguments. And the book that I was carrying was the writings of Karl Marx on America and the Civil War. And I had it in a brown, I'm ashamed to say it now, but I had it in a brown paper bag. And my fiancée, as she then was, she said, "Don't you dare put that book in a brown paper bag. Don't you dare cover up your beliefs." And she said, "Because this is America." And I thought how corny that sounded. But she said, "Because this is America. And you can say whatever you want. And you can believe whatever you want." And like Barry, it hadn't stopped me being elected in the union. That was a while later. We got out of Miami just in time to avoid a gunfight, as a matter of fact, which was exactly summed up why we left Miami at that time. Came to live in Chicago about 20 years ago. I became active in AFSCME in the mid-80s, and I've never lost an election in which I had personal contact with the union members who were voting for me. Because I think people understand that you look them in the eye and you fight for them, and they will accept your beliefs and they will accept you for what you are. And I think I really appreciate that Barry kind of led me into that, making that point, because I think this is really important. I think we're at a turning point. The last time that I can find that the leadership of the US labor movement, and they've reneged right now, Sweeney, and I'm very disappointed in this, has reneged on his opposition to the war. But I think that that will change very rapidly, and I think this meeting is a sign of how fast he's going to have to get back on track. Because as far as I can tell, this is the first time that the American labor movement has opposed and debated imperialism since the 1890s. Labor protested the annexation of Hawaii in 1896 in the run-up to the Spanish-American War of 1898. Samuel Gompers, who they tell us is the father of American labor. I think it's a horrible expression, as if American labor had a father anyway. But he said this. Now, mind you, I should make the point that he was discussing a war in which the other side soldiers may have been the English, so they were white and English-speaking, and that made a difference, I think, to Gompers. But he lashed out at the warmongers in the what was called the Venezuela boundary dispute. He said, "Labor is never for war. It is always for peace. It is on the side of liberty, justice, and humanity." And he went on, "These three are always for peace. Who would be compelled to bear the burden of a war? The working people. They would pay the taxes and their blood would flow like water. The interests of the working people of England and the United States are common. They are fighting the same enemy. They are battling to emancipate themselves from conditions common to both countries. The working people know no country. They are citizens of the world, and their religion is to do what is right, what is just, what is grand and glorious and valorous and chivalrous. The battle for the cause of labor from times of remotest antiquity has been for peace and for goodwill among men." And the labor movement denounced those annexations. They recognized that the imposition of colonial military rule on the peoples of Cuba, for example, would mean strike breaking. And that's exactly what happened. The American military commander in Cuba jailed strikers. And afterwards, this general complained that the biggest complaint he got was from a labor body in Chicago. As you might like that. But over the course of the next few years, really a handful of years, what happened tragically was that the labor movement bought into the idea, or the leadership of what was then a very small labor movement, proportionate to the whole country, bought into the idea that their members would do better out of imperialism, and that they themselves would be able to maintain and increase their standing and their respectability in society if they supported imperialism. And a process occurred where the people who had up until then been the foremost leaders of the labor movement, Gompers and P.J. Maguire, was a lot better, I think, than Gompers, Furuseth, all these characters got onto the war wagon. And by 1904, I think it is, and I'm reading from a book by Philip Thoner, part of the history of the American working class movement. In the spring of 1904, the question of organizing the cigar makers in the Philippine Islands was discussed by the AFL leadership. Although it was agreed that the Filipino cigar makers were willing to better organize, it was finally decided that it would not be wise for the AFL to assist them. The reason? Agitation of Philippine independence, very strong among the better class of workers and kept up by lawyers and doctors, mainly for pecuniary reasons, whatever that meant, has to be taken into consideration when organizing these people. Rather than risk the danger of aiding the cause of Philippine independence and thus antagonizing the Wall Street interests, the AFL leaders agreed not to undertake the organizing campaign. And as Foner went on to say, Foner, who wrote this massive, massive history of the American labor movement, just as British imperialists were able to blunt the anti-imperialist sentiments of organized labor in England by corrupting the skilled workers, giving them a share in the spoils of imperialism, so American imperialists succeeded in achieving this in the United States. Out of the surplus profits derived from imperialism, monopoly capitalism in the United States could afford to pay the highly skilled workers a bit more above the average in order to reconcile them to imperialism, to develop among this strata of the working class a subtle sense of superiority and to destroy their solidarity with their fellow workers and their consciousness of class. And I think that that is what led the AFL to fail to really oppose America's entry into World War I, even though it was massively unpopular at the time, why they failed to organize the unskilled in the packing houses and the steel strikes of the period immediately after the war, why they failed to fight against the Palmer raids, which was the basis of the setting up, really, of the modern FBI, why they didn't manage to understand the significance of the strike movements in the 1930s, why the movement split. That was why the movement split, because only a few unions, led famously by John L. Lewis, understood the need to go out and do mass organizing. And still, unfortunately, since the middle 70s, when the deal really fell apart, and it was only, I think, a massive underlining of the falling apart of that deal when Reagan fired the Patco strikers and broke that union, proving that it didn't matter if you were skilled or considered yourself professional or any of the above. Still, it seems that, unfortunately, there are leaders in the labor movement, the present company absolutely and totally accepted, obviously, who have the illusion that somehow or other we can get along with this government. And I think that to buy into the idea that there is any way of supporting our troops other than by bringing them home and other than by spending the money that we need to spend right here to develop this economy, to develop our educational system, to send our kids to school, to do what we can for the veterans. And by the way, when I was in college in the 70s, there were people still in nursing homes from World War I who never got out. They never left the trenches. Right? That's what war is about. And what we're trying to build here, and I think this meeting is a wonderful step forward, is to build a group here in Chicago that can pull together, that can actually pool the resources of the labor movement and begin to mobilize serious opposition to the war. I think we need to build links with the existing anti-war movement that exists in Chicago and around the country. I think we need to agitate in our workplaces, do everything that is humanly possible to put the case for what supporting our troops really means. And I think we also could maybe learn something from what some of our brothers and sisters in Oakland have recently discussed. This was posted to the U.S. Labor Against the War website. Notes from meeting in Oakland, March 20th. The list of topics discussed, and you can go to the U.S. Law website, of course, and check it out. Response to civil disobedience, political strikes, international labor speakers, objectives of our actions, member education, media exposure, political strategy, town hall meetings, bring the troops home campaign, and tax day protest. And I think the discussion on political strikes was particularly interesting. It's summarized as follows. While everyone agreed that organized labor in the U.S. is not at a point where these are realistic, some felt that opening a discussion about the motivation for and utility of political strikes was useful and necessary to respond to the crisis. It was clear that no one believed that there was any group of workers in the Bay Area ready to walk off their jobs en masse to engage in political strikes against the war. That said, however, were the peace movement to mount a large, credible, nonviolent demonstration at one of the marine terminals to protest loading of military cargo, ILWU, which has a long tradition of observing picket lines, might refuse to work. Their contract has provisions that protect them if they refuse to cross picket lines where a health and safety hazard might exist in doing so. And in order to promote that idea, one idea suggested was to invite some of the labor leaders from other countries who are opposed to the U.S. war to do a speaking tour of the U.S. This would provide union members here with a global view of opposition to U.S. policy and allow them to hear from labor leaders in places where political strikes may be more accepted as legitimate expression within the labor movement. And just in closing, I'd like to say this. I heard a report from a personal friend and comrade who's in Berlin, and it was reported that when the school students were debating going out on strike, and 50,000 school students walked out in Berlin, and a healthcare steward went to his union meeting and said, "We cannot let the youth carry this by themselves. How will we be able to face ourselves if the school students get suspended for going on strike and we don't do the same?" And I think that those ideas are going to have to be discussed and debated within the movement. But not to cut across that what we need to do, I think, in this next period is to build this group, Chicago Labor Against the War, to come to an agreement about what is possible at this stage of the game, if you like. What can we do to build opposition to this war? Because it has to be stopped. Today's Chicago Tribune says that another 100,000 troops are going to be sent out there. It also says, by the way, that they admitted this on the front page of the Tribune, that a majority of New Yorkers, the one city in the United States that has experienced anything like war, a majority of New Yorkers are opposed to this war. With the bourgeois media, the capitalist media doing the poll, they still got a 49 to 47% majority against war.